Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Amy Nussbaum-Gale. I'm here on behalf of petitioner Ali Rafagad, a young man from Pakistan who converted to the Shia religion. He suffered past persecution, well-founded fear of future persecution and torture convention, which he could have proved, but for the fact that he did not have a fair hearing. And I think there are three issues in this case that we want to address. First of all, the denial of the due process under the Fifth Amendment, full and fair hearing. Second, the negative credibility finding. And third, the improper review of the torture convention claim. And in this case,
Before we go into those, are all of those issues exhausted?
Yes, I believe that they are.
Was the adverse credibility determination addressed in the opening brief?
Yes, I believe that first of all, I believe that it was addressed in the notice of appeal, and then in the opening brief.
The brief before this court.
Oh yes, it was addressed in the brief before this court.
How about in the brief before the BIA?
In the brief before the BIA, I believe that the counsel clearly said that there was such a failure of due process. He addressed the issue and he said, normally I would argue all the facts and compare them to the evidence. But in this case, the record is so severely underdeveloped and there is such a lack of a full and fair hearing, and there was no attorney, and the judge took the testimony unfairly. So to that point, he said that there isn't even anything really to address at this point. But of course, he was saying
that the board addressed it, didn't they, in their final decision?
Yeah, the board, when it came to credibility, only upheld the failure to continue and the failure to
The board specifically upheld the adverse credibility determination.
They upheld the adverse credibility determination, but declined to look at the errors of fact and declined to do a clear error review, saying that the counsel had failed to raise it. And I believe that he did not fail to raise it. He's just said that the hearing didn't even meet a threshold standard.
Could you explain to me your due process argument and how does it stand on its own, or is it linked to the request to change a venue, which was kind of odd what happened, and the request for a continuance? Is it all linked together?
I mean, I think that the due process argument is linked together in many respects. The failure to grant a continuance for the attorney, the failure to change venue, the failure to develop the record on the part of the judge who was pro se, the failure of the judge to allow him to have counsel. I mean, he repeatedly asked for counsel. She gave him one continuance at the first master calendar hearing, said, "Do you want to find counsel?" He said, yes, yes, yes. She gave him 2 weeks when he didn't have counsel. She had him prepare his I-589 by himself, swear to the allegations in the charging document, swear to the contents of the pro se, the asylum application prepared by a friend in the detention center. Then she gave him, then she said that he had to go forward in she gave him a short period of time to go forward on the individual calendar hearing. In the meantime, the respondent, the same judge, granted this respondent bond to $35,000 bond to two New York guarantors on the promise that he would live with them in New York. And it took about a month for them to actually post the bond. They posted the bond. He moved to New York and he was given something different. The case was supposed to be moved from the from the detained calendar to the non-detained calendar. So he was given something. He was given administrative forms to fill out for the change of venue. It was like a clerical transfer, an administrative transfer. Within 10 days of getting to New York, he sent in those forms asking for the case to be changed to New York, right, where he lived. And the government received those forms because they filed a non-opposition to the change of venue. However, for some unknown reason, the immigration court wrote return to sender and sent it back to the respondent, who had to jump on a plane within about a day or two.
Hadn't he already hired a lawyer?
Excuse me?
Hadn't he already hired a lawyer at that point?
The lawyer that he hired was only for the bond in California. And in fact, he even asked for that lawyer on the day of the individual when he went back to the detention center, where it was mistakenly calendared. And the judge said, no, that you can't have that lawyer. That lawyer is just for your bond hearing. And in New York, he had not yet hired a lawyer because he just got there. And the case was supposed to be recalendered for a master calendar hearing and then an individual hearing, so that he would have had many, many months to prepare his case. And he had no idea, and he needed to have the lawyer to tell him what documents he needed to get. He had no idea what documents he needed to get. He needed a lawyer to counsel him, to put together his identity documents, to see if his identity documents were correct. He flew nonetheless to the detention center, and when he was supposed to be in a non-detained setting without a lawyer, without any documents, to show up in court based on a non-opposition agreement by the government. When he got to court, the judge simply decided to go forward because, as she says, she had the time slot, the hour and a half time slot made available, and the government withdrew their agreement to the change of venue. So the respondent was just left alone without counsel. He kept begging for counsel. He was left without his identity documents. He was forced to pull, and he was left without his corroborative documents, without witnesses, without an attorney to represent him. And he was forced to pull some documents out of his bag as to his identity that weren't even reviewed, that had arrived in the country after he got here. And then furthermore, the judge, who made him go forward as a pro se, actually didn't fulfill her duty under Pangaliani. She didn't fulfill her duty to Panlinian, Ninth Circuit, 2009. Where the judge who makes someone go forward pro se has a duty to scrupulously and conscientiously probe into, inquire into, and explore all relevant facts. And that's also true in Agamon v. INS.
Counsel, can I get you to answer my question that I never got the answer to about the opening brief and where the adverse credibility determination was discussed?
Yes, let me find my brief. Sorry. For some reason, I know that it was addressed.
That adverse credibility determination was challenged in the opening brief.
Excuse me?
Which specific adverse credibility determination was challenged in the opening brief?
All of them, I believe. I think that what was challenged was
So are you saying you challenged them through your due process argument? Because none of them were listed.
Challenged them specifically in another section as to the credibility.
Could you point me to the page where a specific adverse credibility determination was challenged? And sure. Listed and challenged.
Oh, sorry, I can't hear. Some reason I don't think I have the brief on my desk, although I can tell you that there was an entire section in my brief. Here I have it. I'm so sorry. I apologize. I really apologize. One moment. I said that under the totality of the circumstances,
challenge an adverse credibility determination, don't you have to tell us what the adverse credibility determination was and why it's not, why we're compelled to conclude the opposite on it?
No, I believe that perhaps you're right that it was mentioned under the due process section, but I did mention all of the things that the judge made a mistake on.
Could we turn to the torture claim? Could you point me in the brief where you discussed the torture that was inflicted upon Mr. Ali and why the CAT claim was wrongfully denied? Where is that in your opening brief?
Well, in the torture, it was in the section. We said that the BIA and the IJ improperly took into account, didn't make a separate finding on why there would be torture in this case, that they didn't take into account the country conditions in this case.
All right.
The testimony.
Counsel, let me ask you. Let me ask you a question, counsel.
Sure. Yes.
If we would agree with you that there was a due process violation, we should just grant the petition and remand for a do-over, correct?
I believe so, yes.
And
isn't
I
that
what
wait
you're
a asking? Minute. Don't you have to show prejudice?
Well, I think actually that you don't have to, in this case, you don't have to show prejudice. First of all, there's a case that I hadn't actually mentioned before, Montez Lopez v. Holder, which carves out an exception to the prejudice that says that if you're denied counsel, that's so fundamentally a violation of due process, and you don't have to specifically set forth what the prejudice is because it's so obvious. Furthermore, there are other cases in the Ninth Circuit that set forth that the fact that you don't have to specify exactly what the prejudice is. If you can
what
infer it,
you don't have
from
to
the,
specify what the prejudice is.
Cases would be.
Give me your strongest case for that proposition.
Colmenar v. INS, Zulin v. Gonzalez.
Counsel.
Yes.
Colmenar, was that cited in your brief?
No, that wasn't cited in my brief.
Okay, but maybe we should.
I also believe.
Can I mention one case? I believe it is in the brief, but I don't want to interrupt anyone else.
Go ahead.
I'm done.
Are you familiar with the Tawa Dress versus Ashcroft, 364 Fed 3rd, 1099?
No, I'm not familiar with that case, Your Honor.
This is not a but-for or harmless error standard. In proper circumstances, the petitioner need not explain exactly what evidence he would have presented in support of his application, and we may infer prejudice in the absence of any specific allegation as to what evidence petitioner would have presented had he been provided the opportunity to present evidence. Is that your argument?
Yes, sir, it is. And there's another case that I mentioned in my brief, Gadashi versus INS, but that is my argument, and I thank you. And I'd also like to point out that the BIA, in saying that you had to show prejudice, cited to a case, Zatino. And in that case, that's a case from El Salvador, where the respondent found out, I believe it's El Salvador, found out 10 days before that his attorney had been temporarily suspended, and the judge made him go forward anyway. However, the decision of the judge was actually well-reasoned. He was found credible. And however, the judge denied for lack of nexus. Okay. And in his brief, he basically admitted that there was a lack of nexus. So it was a very different situation. In this case, I think the prejudice is obvious. If he didn't have his lawyer and he didn't have any of his documents and he didn't have fully reviewed or translated identity documents, he was obviously prejudiced. Plus the environment was hostile.
Okay, counsel, we have to let you go way over. We need to hear from the government.
Okay.
Counsel for the government.
Yes, Your Honors. May it please the court, Eric Quick on behalf of respondent. There are three primary issues before Your Honors. One is the adverse credibility issue. Was it properly raised on appeal, either in a board brief or in the opening brief? And if we then go to the actual merits of the adverse credibility finding, the inconsistencies between the documents, and then the 10 examples cited by the immigration judge of non-responsive testimony. Then we have the motion to change venue and the motion to continue, which in our brief we treat as distinct issues. With regard to the credibility issue, as we argue in our opening brief, the board finds that it was not adequately challenged on appeal. The opening brief before that, this court doesn't contest that challenge finding either. And we argue as well, the opening brief itself makes no substantive and proper challenge to the adverse credibility issues. But if we look behind all of that at the adverse credibility, as we mentioned, there are two primary ones that are document inconsistencies. It has nothing to do with testimony. One is with regard to Mr. Ali's birth date, where when we see his asylum application on page 166.
Can I ask you a question? I have a hard time when the United States agrees to a continuance, a person flies halfway around the country with the expectation that that's, even though it's up to the judge, that the United States made an agreement and the United States should abide by that agreement, and the United States reneges on that agreement. I have a hard time understanding how that doesn't taint this proceeding. And then you have on top of that, the petitioner mentioning multiple times that he's not feeling well. So, you know, again, just looking at everything in this case, do you think it's okay for the government to sign a written agreement, not opposing a continuance, and then change its mind in the hearing?
Well, Your Honor, if we look at what's going on, to answer your question here, in this hearing, before the DHS counsel even talks about their position on this, because the immigration judge is aware of the position initially, the immigration judge asked Mr. Ali what evidence you have. He says, I want to change my case. Mr. Ali, why are you not prepared? The immigration judge asked on 107. And he says, well, they will help me a little. I will give them money. After my work permit, I will pay them. Then the immigration judge asks once again on page 107, why are you not prepared after 7 months? I want to change my case. I do not have money. Then the immigration judge summarizes on 108, I'm not hearing a lot of good reasons for you to delay your case. You have to show good cause. Then a couple of pages later, DHS is asked their position. And at that point, DHS has heard what Mr. Ali has to say. So from the record, it seems that DHS counsel is hearing that there is no good cause.
I mean, when I read the transcript, it seemed to me that a lot of his answers were not responsive and or confused. And I just felt like I'm not sure this guy really understands. He's not sophisticated, the scope of what's being asked, particularly when it seems reasonable to for him to have believed that there was going to be a continuance. And, you know, he asks multiple times and says, I don't feel well. So, I, you know, just as a trial judge, when someone says, I don't feel well, all the red flags go up. And I immediately think, well, I've got a duty to inquire further about this, because this isn't just a pro forma thing when you're dealing with some person. So I asked you whether it was acceptable for the government to break its agreement in terms of a continuance. And you told me, I guess, yes.
I don't know if it's an agreement or a position at the time before the DHS counsel has heard anything about the reasons. We don't say that it's an agreement. It was a position earlier in the proceedings.
Could you clarify one thing for me? He filed the motion to change venue. The government received it. Apparently, the immigration court returned it to him. Had the immigration court not returned it, is it pretty perfunctory that it just would have been granted as an administrative matter and his case would have been transferred to New York?
Well, there are a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. It's not clear from the record that the immigration court rejects it. If we look on page 35 with all of the stamps, it seems as though the U.S. Postal Service has put a return to sender, unable to forward stamp on it, for whatever reason. We just don't know from the record why this is. But from the record, I don't believe we can say the immigration court returned.
Now, let's assume for a moment. I just want to make, had it, let's assume it got filed with the immigration court. Is this kind of a perfunctory kind of matter? Government doesn't oppose transfer?
I think that question goes into the clerical transfer argument of the opening brief in which Ms. Gilman made today. I am not aware of a clerical transfer proceeding or process. Notably, the opening brief doesn't give that to us either.
I gather you have more familiarity with how this operates than I do. I mean, you know, I'm just curious whether or not it would be somewhat a perfunctory. It's not opposed by the government and have been filed with, you know, these things just handled pretty routinely and they get transferred to New York where the petitioner resides.
Well, under matter of Raman, we still have to look at a good cause standard, as does the ACFR 3.20. And the immigration judge on January 16th, we must remember, cautions Mr. Ali, the same judge. So I'll reset your case to March 13th. Any supporting documents will be due from either party on February 13th. I'm going to expect you to be ready to do your case on that date, sir. So you should be requesting your documents as soon as possible and hiring an attorney as soon as possible. Otherwise, I'm going to expect you to handle your case and represent yourself on that date. It says that on page 101.
He's in custody at that time, is that right?
He is in custody, yes. He also, we should remember from the records on pages 247 and 248, he is given a list of possible pro bono service organizations, both in Otemese, four of those, and then in San Diego, five of those. And he signs receipt of that. It's not dated, but in the record, it's between two documents dated November 6th and November 12th. So one could infer from that he receives and signs it between those two dates. So he's aware, at least, of the possibility of pro bono counsel. We hear that he wants to go to New York and get a work permit, as the immigration judge surmises on 112, get a work permit, save money, and then hire a lawyer. The immigration judge determines, yes, ma'am, yes, Your Honor.
If we agree that there was a due process violation, is it your position that Mr. Ali would still have to show prejudice?
It is, Your Honor. It is. Both under the, if we're looking at a motion to continue context, matter of LABR would tell us that. And from a venue context, matter of Raman would tell us we do need that. As we point out in our brief, however, with regard to the continuance, LABR isn't mentioned, nor is its factors. There's no claim of prejudice. There's no claim of abuse of discretion. And notably, with the board brief itself, there's nothing to indicate what documents would have been presented or what witnesses would have been presented. There's simply nothing here from the record to indicate an abuse of discretion for either the continuance or the venue issue, and certainly no prejudice. Well, yes, that is our position.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but as I read the brief on appeal to us on this due process issue and the motion to continue and the motion to change venue, I read counsel's argument to be all related. That is, the failure to grant a continuance left him on his own at this hearing, essentially unprepared, without any help. He thought that the matter was going to be transferred back to New York, and he was forced to go ahead. You read the transcript, it's really not, it's not satisfying at all. That transcript really shows this guy didn't know what was going on.
He seems, I believe the judge says, he's surprised. The board brief talks about there is an emotional surprise about this. But again, we don't really know what he's going through because there's no affidavit after this to tell us what his subjective intent or perceptions were or expectations were. We just don't know. It's called, he arrived unprepared and he had an emotional shock, says the board brief. That's all we're really told. He was told by the immigration judge, no matter what, you must be prepared on that March date. He's told that 2 months prior. So this cannot have been, at least objectively from the record, a complete surprise. That passage I read from page 101 made fairly clear what that same immigration judge's expectations were.
You don't think he might have been surprised when the government filed a non-opposition and then the government you know, said just the opposite at the hearing?
I don't know. We don't know. What do you think, from the record, at least?
Can I ask another question? If we find a due process violation, do we still need to decide the adverse credibility question? And how can that possibly be done?
If your honors find there are due process violations on both venue and continuance, and that prejudice was alleged and demonstrated, indeed your honors find that requisite, then you do have to get to the adverse credibility. If there is, you determine you don't need the prejudice, you didn't have to at least allege that or show what documents he was going to do or what witnesses he would have brought, then we don't get to the adverse credibility issue.
Sorry, just go back for a new hearing. That's essentially what I understand they were asking for. Start over.
We'd have to find
there didn't need to be a showing of prejudice, or that the showing was made.
That would be correct. And as our brief points out, there's simply nothing on that board brief to tell us what documents I would have produced for Mr. Ali. There's just nothing for the board to look at as far as prejudice, or what would happen. So it is our position there from our brief that there was certainly no abuse of discretion there, because there was just nothing for the immigration, nothing for the board to look at, Your Honors.
So would you just summarize for me, let's assume for a moment there is no due process violation. What's the government's position as to why there's substantial evidence to support the adverse credibility determination?
Well, there were really two components to that, Your Honor. One was the birth date issue, where the asylum application on page 166 has one date in December of 1994, and his birth date or birth certificate on page 165 has another date in December. Then there's the issue with his mother. The asylum application on page 169 talks about Farida Fakim, that's her name, from the village of Jada, but his own birth certificate on page 165 says her name is Zita Bibi. Two completely different individuals, seemingly. So the immigration judge mentions both of these. And again, the opening brief doesn't substantially contest that these two document inconsistencies do exist in records. So that's certainly sufficient. And then the 10 unresponsive examples that the immigration judge points out, which are not necessarily tied in with any due process challenge. There are things like what happens to him in Pakistan? Why would he be killed in Pakistan? Why did he convert? Why did it take him 9 months to leave Pakistan? All of these unresponsive answers.
What was unresponsive about why did you convert?
Well, he says, well, why did you change? And this is on page 141. Why did you change? And he says, well, we like them. Judge, well, what did you like? What about them did you like? Well, I'm not feeling well, Your Honor. And then the judge says, this is not a difficult question to answer. Why are you having difficulty answering about why you converted? And then the judge says, let the record reflect, there's no response in a long pause. Other than we like them, there is no answer.
Why is that such a improper answer? People, a lot of religious organizations provide community services. They are embedded in all sorts of community functions, medical care, all these things. I mean, to say for an unsophisticated person without follow-up, I like them, I don't find that to be, a strange thing for someone to say. You know, and he says, well, I'm not feeling well. So I don't know. It just, it almost seems like, you know, that's not a good reason. But to me, it seemed like I could understand that. They're nice to me. You know, in these kinds of very poor community, you know, we can't apply our own standards. I don't find that answer to be particularly strange.
Okay.
So, counsel, were any of these arguments made in the opening brief, though, regarding this specific adverse credibility determination?
With regard to the 10 non-responsive.
With regard to any of the adverse credibility determinations, were any of those?
We certainly argue no, not sufficiently, not at all. Certainly, there's nothing. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Were any of these adverse credibility determinations listed at all in the opening brief?
The document inconsistencies were not, I think on perhaps the penultimate page, there was a mention it exists, but there's no explanation or allegation that it was improperly found. Some of the 10 or unresponsive issues are, but in a different context, Your Honor, not in an adverse credibility argument context, but for instance, what documents he waits would then be within that continuance or venue change issue. The others, no, they are not sufficiently responded to in the opening brief.
I tried to get it, I couldn't do it.
Does the court have any other questions?
Yeah, thank you, counsel. I let this go on a little bit long. I'll give petitioner just 1 minute only, and that's all you get is 1 minute, because we've exceeded our time. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Turn on your mic, counsel. Okay, we still can't hear you.
You're muted.
Okay, there you go. You got 1 minute now, make it quick. You're still muted.
Is that unmuted now?
Now you're okay. You got 1 minute.
Okay. In terms of credibility, we addressed in the brief that the pauses were caused by the fact that the judge was just disagreeing with everything he said, which was actually consistent with his I-589 and his credible fear. In terms of the identity document, in terms of the birth date and his mother's name, there was one document, a birth certificate, which he admitted was wrong. He pulled out of his, it was obtained after he left the country, and he pulled it out of his bag and he said it was wrong. His national ID card, his passport, his I-589, his credible fear, all had consistent information. This was one non-fully translated document that she's referring to. That's the two that relates to the mother's name and his name. The mother's name might have been a nickname. He was a guy on his own. He also said that he converted because not only because he liked them, but that he went to the Imambagar, which is the Shia mosque. And the judge
Your minute is up. So thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments this morning from both sides.
Thank you very much.
Interesting case. Matter is submitted.
Thank you.